Great morning, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Thank God for Monday. I'm Brother Greg Cellini of the Franciscan Brothers of Brooklyn in the Office of Mission, Ministry, and Interfaith Dialogue at St. Francis College in beautiful Brooklyn, New York. My great pleasure to be back with you once again today. The purpose of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to inspire you, our audience, to take personal responsibility for your professional satisfaction. We want to provide you hope, healing, and peace in these unprecedented, turbulent, uncertain times, motivate you to search deep inside yourself in the quest for fulfillment. Listeners, it's really up to you how to utilize the information we provide today, take full accountability for the decisions you make, and a resulting outcome. And one of the goals of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to introduce role models of people who take very bold steps in their work lives. This is a very special time in the workplace and the world when diversity, equity, and inclusion have never been more important. And as such, we are honored today to have with us not only one, but two most special guests. Their names are Bertina Ceccarelli and Suzanne Tedrick. Suzanne and Bertina are the authors of the enlightening book, Innovating for Diversity: Lessons from Top Companies Achieving Business Success Through Inclusivity. Great morning and welcome to Thank God for Monday, Bertina and Suzanne.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here this morning.
The honor is all ours. Kindly share with the listeners and me from what city and state you're speaking from this morning. Maybe Bertina, we can start with you, please.
Beautiful downtown Brooklyn.
Oh, there's no place in the world like it. Suzanne, how about you?
I am joining everyone from Stuyvesant Town in New York City.
Wow, another great neighborhood, certainly. Well, it's a great honor to have both of you with us today. Sadly, we've only got 30 minutes. We could spend hours talking about your backgrounds, this fabulous book. We're going to jump now right into the deep end of the pool. With so many companies acknowledging that good DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion practices advance the bottom line and are so important legally and morally, help us out. Why do we still see glaring gaps in representation in high growth sectors of our economy?
You know, Greg, maybe I'll kick us off, and I know Suzanne certainly has a lot of thoughts on this very topic as well too. But you know, I think in your opening remarks, you said it so well, is that there's never been a more important time to really double down on diversity, equity, and inclusion, particularly given the changing demographics here in the U.S. and frankly globally. We have to, as an economy, get better at harnessing the power of diversity. But I think in our research and on all the case studies that we did, some of the barriers preventing companies from doing this well really boil down to three things: inertia, not prioritizing innovation, and especially connected to diversity, and not being very good about having humility. So this whole construct, right, of thinking about innovating for diversity, when we think of companies that are not necessarily innovating generally, they're certainly not innovating for diversity and not deploying the principles that allow innovation and therefore diversity to take root. Suzanne, what are some of your thoughts?
I certainly agree with you on humility. I think it's hard for many leaders and organizations to highlight perhaps some of those places where there are shortcomings, which leads, I think, a little bit into that inertia of like, I don't want to act. You know, how do I make this better? If I'm not necessarily receiving the kind feedback that I thought that I would be receiving for this if necessary. I think in more recent times too, I think that there is this undercurrent where people are asking the question, well, what is the value of DEI? And perhaps probably painting DEI in perhaps more of a negative light than is intended. And so I think that distracts and takes away from what I think is an important foundation, an important building block for most, for all businesses, is to have a wonderful environment where everyone feels that they are included and that they belong.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. And it's so interesting, the title of your book, Innovating for Diversity. Before becoming a Franciscan Brother of Brooklyn, I had a 30-year career in pharmaceuticals. So innovation, of course, very, very important. What are some of the barriers that impede innovation, especially those connected to diversity? Bertina, Suzanne, help us out here, please.
Sure, I can start here. So I think some of the more common culprits are, you know, we don't have time, we don't have the money, we already have something in place. So again, just kind of relying on this is how it's always been. Why go against that grain? Why invest all that time, money, and resources if we're not expecting a better outcome in the process? Which is unfortunate. Which is very, very unfortunate. And I think to some extent, and we talked about this a little bit in the book, I think when people think about innovation, they think about it in a more technical lens. They think more about, you know, what is the latest and greatest that the big tech companies are doing, where I kind of frame innovation as really just taking a different look, a different approach to a particular problem. Maybe it's looking at it differently or taking a new set of actions. So it doesn't necessarily need to be technical in nature. It's just more of really caring about the issue and really trying to find ways of, well, how do we make this better? How do we make this better, and how do we improve upon that?
Yeah, and I would say it's, you know, asking those questions overcomes, right, the level of arrogance that is contrary to the humility as a quality required for innovation to flourish. So if we kind of go back, right, to some of those three barriers, inertia, not prioritizing resources for innovation, and lack of humility, if we just double click on humility for a moment, you know, we in the book talk about a couple of companies who had just fantastic track records of success in certain product categories. And as those products became more and more successful and leaders decided to move on, the very process and culture that helped to develop successful products in the very beginning began to fade. And, you know, we know the rest on your laurels meme. Sometimes what happens is that history of success or culture of success also leads to complacency, where asking the questions and being curious and digging deeper to say, hey, if we're not refreshing our game all the time, we're going to lose that innovation muscle. And other businesses will come in and take market share and innovate circles around us, eventually leading to, you know, bankruptcy or worse. So we've seen that cycle play out from time to time if there's just not a really careful, thoughtful approach to say, we need to be on our game and constantly slightly paranoid at all times to be able to ensure that we are innovating. And arguably, those same qualities and characteristics apply to when you think about the composition of your workforce. And are you really being actively intentional in thinking through all the ways that you could recruit, develop, and retain the most outstanding talent, which is going to be the most diverse talent?
That's so wonderful, the thoughts that both of you shared. Now, it's interesting you mentioned culture, because if we perceive correctly, you talk about five cultural characteristics necessary for innovation, or certainly many cultural characteristics. Would you like to share some of these with the audience and I now, please?
Sure. I'm happy to get started there. So one of the ones that we talk about very, very profoundly is courage. Being able to have the courage to ask the hard questions, to have the difficult conversations, to see where perhaps there could be better ifs, what could be done better, and really having the mental fortitude to carry out what needs to be done. In all of the case studies that we've had the pleasure of covering for the book, definitely some meaty issues within each company that they had to kind of face ahead, you know, face on, which was, you know, it can be very challenging for most businesses, very, very challenging. And where some leaders may decide, this is not my fight, or I can't, all of the leaders that we spoke to during the course of the book said, no, not only can I, but we must, for the livelihood of our company and for everyone here. So having the courage to do what is hard, to do what is difficult, by far is one of the most important aspects that are necessary within the organization.
Other qualities that we surfaced as those cultural precedents that we believe is required to build an innovative culture includes, in addition to courage, trust, collaboration, risk-taking, and leadership. When you have those five things combined, and I think this is, you know, further puts a fine point on Suzanne's notes around courage, is that there is an appetite to challenge the fixed attitudes and the fixed practices that can prevent a company from both innovating, right, as well as thinking deeply about, again, what is required from a cultural perspective to ensure that diversity, equity, and inclusion are successful all throughout the organization, starting from the very top.
Wow, that's fascinating, no doubt about it. Now, I'm sorry, I have to ask this next question. I don't want to, but I feel compelled to, due to the two great experts that I have with me today. Why do organizational DEI efforts seem often to flounder or even fail? Again, I hate to ask this question. Help us out, please.
Well, it's I as hard as a question as it is, it's a necessary one that I think all leaders need to ask. And it's not one particular thing in some cases, but it's mostly a laundry list, so to speak, of things that aren't present. One of the things that we definitely see from a less successful standpoint is when people approach it as a check the box type of activity.
Oh,
you know, I've done X, we're done. I've solved for diversity. No, like we can go on with our the rest of our day. Rather than treating it as, you know, and I know that it's a little bit cliche to say that DEI is a journey, but it really is. And it's not one, it changes over time. It changes with the organization. And we can't treat it as a to-do list. So treating it as such, you know, usually doesn't lead to the best outcomes. Another thing that we've seen is where we're doing it because we're required to do so. We're doing this more from a compliance standpoint.
Wow.
I genuinely care about this and think it's important for the livelihood of my business. Again, it's kind of the checklist mentality. If I'm doing it because someone's telling me to do it, I'm probably not going to put in my all and my best in those cases.
Sure. Yeah, that makes total sense, no doubt about it. Now, if I perceive correctly from your great book, you talk about an apprenticeship model for developing diverse talent. Talk a little bit about this model, please, and maybe some of the keys to this model's success.
Yeah, you know, Greg, I appreciate you asking that question. And in fact, it's just the opposite, right, of why diversity efforts fail. And, you know, Suzanne articulated those, that kind of check the box mentality. I think in the two case studies, Citibank and Accenture, where we talked about pioneering an apprenticeship concept to attract talents from sources they would typically not tap, right? Because these are organizations that historically really looked at college graduates. This is an opportunity to source talent from a much, much broader pool, very talented and motivated individuals who just might not have had the opportunity to pursue a college degree. So when we think about diversity efforts failing because companies are following a check the box approach, I think in both of these cases, they were examining root causes, getting underneath their internal systems to say, what can we do differently to introduce a different profile of individual into our company and really help them succeed? So let's get to causes. Let's solve a core business problem and recognize that diversity is going to be part of the solution. So in the apprenticeship model, it was A, first identifying what kind of roles, right, could be suitable for an apprenticeship approach. And in this case, it was information technology, something not characteristically thought about in the apprenticeship model, where we often think about it as construction trades. The second is really in the case of Citi, taking a look at the veteran community, where they had a very strong network of employees who were military veterans. That appropriate that we talk about this here on Memorial Day morning, deeply committed to employing veterans, but wanting to expand that net to include individuals who might not, again, have benefited from a college degree or had deep IT experience, but so many outstanding qualities that would allow them to succeed. So they created a program where for 12 months they were surrounded by compassionate leadership, additional technical training, and really a community that helped them connect to the culture at Citi. And arguably, Accenture took a very similar approach with a deeply thoughtful training program and a commitment to say, within 6 to 12 months, these will be individuals that are tapped into full-time jobs. And in both cases, the conversion rates are in excess of 90%. And the majority of the talent brought in through the apprenticeship programs are diverse along many different metrics. So these are companies that have become huge advocates for the apprenticeship model that they expect to scale nationally.
Oh, that's awesome. No doubt about that. Now, I've got a second question I don't want to ask, but again, feel compelled to, because both of you are experts in this area as well. We hear so much about mentorship programs, the importance of mentoring. But again, it seems like a lot of organizations fail at having thriving mentor programs. Any thoughts on why this is, Bertina or Suzanne, or maybe both of you, please?
Yeah, so I'm happy to take this question. So for me, mentoring has been a very crucial and key part of my career development, both as a mentee and a mentor. And I think what happens with most mentoring programs is that everyone goes in with the best of intentions. And so that, you know, you pair up someone who happens to, you know, have a wealth of experience and then someone that wants to take part in that experience, but without really trying to understand, well, what exactly is this mentee looking for out of this relationship? And to what extent is the mentor ready to provide that for people? Is this person indeed have the skills to be a mentor? And sometimes that's a harder conversation because while yes, you can be as knowledgeable as possible in your field, that doesn't necessarily translate that you have the best skills to be a mentor to somebody because it requires patience, requires, you know, empathy, you know, being able to kind of put yourself in the shoes of someone that probably has not had your life experiences. And so very commonly what happens is for most programs, they decide to pair people on a very, very surface level. So if I say I'm interested in business, okay, let's pair Suzanne with someone who happens to have 20 years of business experience, but could care less about mentoring. they just want to put something on the resume and keep things going. Where we've seen success are in places like Coca-Cola and Zendesk, where a great deal of time is put into not just that surface level interest, but really thinking about, do we both know what to expect from each other as a mentor and a mentee? You know, what are our communication styles? What are our conflict styles? What are we trying to get out of this? What kind of support are we getting from the organization? How do we keep this going? How do we operationalize this? And in both of those case studies, they really went deep down to kind of take this beyond just, it's nice to be mentored, to let's have metrics, let's have, you know, real meaningful, deep lasting relationships with one another.
Oh, that is amazing. No doubt about it. I can see where that pairing of individuals would be very important. Bertina, did you want to share on this?
You know, I just, and Suzanne did some outstanding research on mentorship. And one of the things that struck me in the chapter that she wrote on this topic was also how Zendesk was really intentional in the goal for the mentoring program, also supporting diverse young women, particularly women engineers, to move up in the organization to senior level managers. And so they, you know, they measured their success. They had clear goals. And, you know, at the end of the trial period, they had a significant percent increase in the number of young women who were prepared to be promoted into mid-level and then senior level roles. So it just, I think, also speaks to the fact that measurement matters.
No question about it. That is great. I'm a recovering CPA, so bottom line and measurement just warm my heart still. We know small businesses are very, very important to our economy, not only in the five boroughs where we are, but our state and the country and the world. But there's some additional challenges that small businesses face when it comes to implementing DEI.
So I think the biggest challenge is, well, with any small business, it's always trying to prioritize what to do with the very limited resources that they have. And no question, with trying to develop a diversity, equity, and inclusion program, it can be very challenging, not only because you may not necessarily have funds to devote specifically for that, but you may not necessarily have the people and expertise to kind of run that as well.
Wow.
So it's kind of this, the entrepreneur's challenge, you know, like how do I do more with the very, very limited things that I have to, do. And I think for small businesses that want to go into diversity, equity, inclusion, it's almost the same advice that we would say for most major organizations, in that it's best to start small and understand what it is exactly that they're the outcomes that they would like to have for their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Historically, on average, most companies spend anywhere from $3,000 to $1 million+ on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs a year. And that's a lot. That's a lot. That's not money to just, you know, kind of, you know, sneeze at. However, there are ways that we can, you know, leverage the expertise of others. There are programs that entrepreneurs and small businesses can particularly go after. One of the case studies that we featured was for a construction supply company out in the Midwest, where they were focusing on, well, how do we make diversity and equity and inclusion matter for us? And what they decided to do, the president of the company actually reached out to a local economic organization that was offering free diversity, equity, and inclusion training to the participants, as well as providing, well, what should your diversity, equity, and inclusion plan look like, along with some metrics, along with some things, or what are going to be our measurements for success over the next year, 2 years, and 5 years. And so that's very invaluable help that small businesses can receive from other local organizations without having to spend a ton of money to do so.
That's really, really great advice for the smaller organizations where you say every dollar counts, no question about it. We could talk all day, Bertina and Suzanne. Sorry to say, we've only got about 6 minutes, but still some important questions to ask you. Let's talk about a couple of top reasons employees are leaving their places of employment. I know there's a war for talent going on right now. And should these be a concern when diversity and inclusion are priorities? Help us out in these areas, please.
So, you know what we're finding, there's a recent Society of HR Managers, SHRM, survey that was done late last year, really identifying the top three reasons that we're seeing employees of any age leave their companies. The top one is inadequate compensation, right? In terms of salary, bonus, profit sharing, the entire package. That's 74%. Some of that is, of course, attributed to increasing inflation and causing a fair amount of job hopping. Second is just lack of career development. So that comes in at the list at 61%. So investing in the development and retention really does have a very hard ROI when you think about giving people opportunity to flex their career muscles and their new skills. And thirdly, and we hear this a lot, particularly in this era of more and more hybrid working, lack of workplace flexibility. That comes in number three at 43%. So those, I think, really intersect well with this conversation around diversity, because we have seen historically gaps in pay equity between marginalized groups, especially Black and Latinx populations and majority populations, and opportunities to really think very, very deeply around a company's pay equity priorities and practices, given that that issue is the number one reason for departures, can go a long distance towards shoring up one's DEI efforts.
And just to add to that, Bertina, I think especially when it comes to bringing in diverse talent, the other part of the equation is keeping diverse talent. And when we factor in there are maybe five different generations in the workplace right now, and we're building all of these diverse audiences that are coming into the workplace, I think employers need to be more strategic about what keeps people there, and that what one compensation and benefits package looks like for one does not speak to everybody else. The question about remote work, certainly that's going to be going on for quite some time, but for many people, for many diverse audiences, it's a game changer for women, for people who have physical disabilities, even for people who identify as people of color who have said that they've suffered less microaggressions because they feel like they're in a safer space than the office. So I do think that employers, as they move forward, should have a deeper think about what it means to keep employees and think about all of the different range of opportunities and options that are available.
I'm going to put my former CPA hat on again. Retention means dollars, and people walking out the door is a lot of impact to the bottom line in a negative way. Hopefully, these organizations, truly for DEI purposes, will wake up, but also realizing there is a bottom line impact as well. We've saved the most important question for last, Bertina and Suzanne. From where can our loyal listeners purchase Innovating for Diversity? How can they best follow both of you, please?
Sure thing. So Innovating for Diversity is available for with all of the major retailers. So feel free, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, whichever your favorite books reseller is. We do have a book website called innovatingfordiversity.com, where you can reach out to Bertina and myself and follow us on our appropriate social media links.
Terrific. Audience, no excuse. This great book, Innovating for Diversity: Lessons from Top Companies Achieving Business Success Through Inclusivity, available all over the place. Let me give you the spelling of these great authors: Bertina Ceccarelli, Ceccarelli; Suzanne Tedrick, TEDRICK. These are two great Franciscans. They could have just written this great book and held on to the good. No, they came on Thank God for Monday this morning, shared their good. Buy one for yourself. This makes a great gift. High school graduations coming up. College graduations have happened already. Give these books to the class of 2023. It'll really help shape their careers. Again, Suzanne and Bertina, we can't thank you enough for coming on Thank God for Monday today. We've been enlightened. You've inspired me. You've inspired our listeners as well. Continued success and great joy and contribution, this wonderful work that you're doing. So important to Brooklyn and Manhattan, New York State, and the world. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Listeners, guess what? Once again, we're out of time. Greg saying our hope and prayer is that when you wake up on Monday morning, just like Suzanne and Bertina do, you'll say, thank God for Monday. Until next week's episode, have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.